Welcome to another episode of Speed Change Repeat. Today with Juan Bernabe Moreno. I'm really proud of myself that I got your name right.
You did a good job.
So, hi Juan. Thanks for having us today and being on our show. So we always start our episode the same way, and we ask our guests basically to kind of go in a storytelling way through their professional life. You know, nothing too long. You know, of course you had a lot of stuff going on, but just the most important stations that you had, and what shaped you there and basically got you to where you are today.
Okay, thank you for having me. I'm following your program, so it's I really like it, and I really like that you are addressing this AI topic from a completely different perspective. So it's really cool, and for sure I'm in if it's about cool things. So I'm very glad to be here. Regarding my professional career so far, well, I started very early. I mean, I'm 40 years old, so I've started quite early, just in the computer science space. And by that time, we didn't have such a hype, for sure. And the guys, the people doing that, they were a kind of nerds. And it wasn't very, also, the typical profession that you find a lot of girls. So it was like a lot of... the character was a very nerdy character. And by that time, we call it data mining. It was data mining, not AI. And it was a very much a kind of a niche, kind of a very exotic place to be. But ever since, I've been loving so working with data. And basically, ever since in all my career, using data to solve problems. That's basically what I do for a living, right? And after my studies, so I started as a software engineer. And I think it's very good because people sometimes neglect the IT aspect of data science. It's by all means an engineering science. So you really need to be aware of the IT system as well. So I started as a software engineer. I've been working in many companies, coding, hardcore coding. I've been doing a lot of offshoring, so working with India, which is an amazing experience with great people there. You can do a lot of mistakes as well, but at the end, if you do it in a proper way, it's very enriching. And I started as a consultant as well. So I've been just working as a consultant for big companies in Spain, in UK, in Germany. And I decided to to join a Spanish company in Germany, which is Telefonica. So I started my days in the telco industry. I think it was back in 2009, so quite long ago. And my first job there was like taking all the data that we had to make a difference in the web channel. So to support the decision making at a time that wasn't that advanced. So we had to create personalized algorithms by ourselves, and we had to use all the data possible. But the good thing is like the companies doing that, they were really enjoying an advantage, competitive advantage, because this space wasn't so standardized like today. So today everybody can do it with a couple of clicks and a double click server from Google, something like that, right? So after this very nice business-oriented data analytics phase, I decided to jump into the big data wave. Telefonica decided to monetize the data that they have. How is that? The big data was very trendy at that moment. And Telefonica recognized the need for, why don't we just use this data to create a new business model? So how can we just monetize the data that we have? And it was quite nice because big data technology weren't that mature by that moment, which means that we were really fighting overnight to get a stabilized version of the MongoDB database to support particular use cases.
So was that, were you like using like also open source approaches all the time. So like Hadoop and all that stuff.
All along.
Right? Okay.
Hadoop was kind of a mid of 2012. So Hadoop wasn't very much adopted yet. So we were very much using the most robust NoSQL database. Yeah. So MongoDB, but yeah. MongoDB wasn't very stable at that point.
Yeah.
So it was this technology was giving us a hard time.
So there was also I'm not really sure when that one started with MapReduce and stuff. I think that was it that time or was it a little bit later?
No, it was that time. We tried with Hadoop for sure, and at the end we ended up doing it in Hadoop.
Yeah.
But we tried first with the NoSQL MongoDB, and instead of doing the MapReduce stuff, we used the I think it was called by that time the MongoDB aggregation framework, and it was kind of based on kind of distribution of loads and sharding stuff,
right.
And we managed to deliver a decent product. The use case was very clear, and we had a lot of data from the telephony network, and we were in a position of computing crowd analytics, how crowds were moving, right? Because you have these handover events between antenna, and we could count crowds, of course, in a very anonymized way. And it was funny because it's the first time that I learned about anonymization versus something that I was doing in UK for UK first. And when we tried to do it in Germany, we faced the distinction between pseudo anonymization and anonymization.
Yeah.
And for me, it was a thing because working in UK, it wasn't a thing. It was just if you hashed it in the proper way, you got it anonymized.
Yeah.
In Germany, it wasn't enough. And we had at the end, we ended up implementing an anonymization platform to make sure that nobody.
So you had to build that one from scratch?
Yes.
Jesus.
It took us 2 years to get it certified by the authorities here.
Oh my God!
So it was.
That sounds horrible.
Seriously, to be honest, now I think that privacy and data protection is an asset.
Is it still used? Do you know whether that platform is still used?
I think they've been evolving that, but I think they are using that still, Telefonica.
Well, then at least it was worth it, right?
Yeah. I mean, the time to market could have been improved, but
but it can always be.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, it was a really interesting time because we were productizing data, so we were making money for a company or monetizing data for a company to create new revenue streams.
So how were you monetizing that data? What did you create? So because the thing is, I've worked with, let's say, on this topic of data monetization, right? So I've intensely researched on that matter for like a whole year. And so ultimately, there's like three ways that you can go about it, right? So you either sell data, right? You're a raw data provider. You build services, right? Which is the second one. So you, in terms of, let's say, you having the capabilities to analyze that data and you selling these insights through whatever way, right? And the third one, actually kind of like, again, this platform approach where you create a platform where you kind of like try to give people access through an API or whatever, right? So kind of this approach. So how were you going about this?
Actually, we've done a bit of all three plus a fourth one. Let me just comment on that. The first thing that we've done is like we sell this data.
Okay.
We sold this data, but the problem is you get commoditized.
Right.
Because as Telefonica, we were selling this data to BMW.
Mm-hmm.
Just for them to compute in their navigation systems when and where you have congestions.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if you count many network events in a particular place, and you can just detect that this is a transient place, but they are kind of static there, then of course you can detect a congestion.
Right.
Nowadays, probably it's obsolete because you have this Google of this world. Right?
Yeah.
So that was the first attempt, and we've done that for a year. Then we tried to kind of sell the insights, not the data.
Okay.
So we created services. And we were creating a library of services, and we were making these services available. The problem is like the companies we were selling these insights to, they weren't in a position of consuming kind of APIs or something like that.
Yeah.
So we had to build a self-service front end. And they were kind of coming, seeing the reports, and downloading some data in Excel, and they were kind of in the Excel.
Okay, yeah.
And then, of course, we said, well, why don't we just develop it further as an ecosystem? Not a platform. We called it ecosystem at that time. At the end, it's a set of platforms together. And we tried to do that as well. And we started with use cases for retail, for retailers. Like, we had big customers like big supermarkets in UK. So Tesco, Morrisons, these
chains. Yeah.
And then we decided to create on the same platform, so analytics or services for further verticals like transportation with the same data. And the fourth way of selling insights, monetizing these insights, was like consultancy services. So we found that these companies, they were having the need for our insights, but they didn't have necessarily the department just in a position of taking decision with these insights. Okay. So we provided a consultancy.
You mean from workforce. A telecommunications perspective?
No. We were selling crowd movement insights, right? But for example, catchment. Catchment is like for a particular supermarket, when are the customers coming from?
Okay.
It's really important to understand or to take decisions like, can I keep this site? Can I close this site? Who are my competitors? With whom we are kind of fighting for this particular customer, for this particular municipality.
So is it then geo data?
It was very much geo related.
Okay.
And having this consultancy workforce was very useful because we could embed these insights in the decision making of these big companies. It was the way of bridging the gap between insights and decision making for these companies.
I get it. And what was then the next step?
Well, after Telefonica, so it was funny because usually when you create a product for outside companies, they start asking themselves the question, well, why can't we ourselves the best customer of our own insights, right? So they decided to kind of found a department here for Telefonica Germany. It wasn't any longer global stuff. It was kind of a local role here in Germany. And the briefing was very, very simple. It's like all this good stuff with data and analytics, let's try to kind of embrace it here for our businesses. Mm-hmm. Let's try to transform our business in a way that everything is kind of data driven. Basically, and we started in the with the department or with the channel where we have more data, which is the online, so the digital, everything, so digital marketing online, and we managed to build something called Digital Command Center.
Okay,
it was the first time that we could pull all the insights together.
Yeah,
and we were using these insights to take decisions about offering. To understand the competition, we were kind of scrapping data from all the web to understand which offering were there, with whom we were competing, instead of just having the, the typical campaign look that you say, well, actually, I'm going to plan this so far, but at the time, you could just make a way more informed decisions, taking into account the context of the competition, the pricing. We were coupling campaigns with manufacturers, for example, the typical Apple iPhone launch in September, all the Septembers, right?
Yeah.
And we were coupling actions there so that we could benefit from the buzz and the hype.
Yeah, okay.
So it was a very interesting time, and we managed to transform the way we were running this kind of activities. Okay. We started in the online department and we moved to the call center department. And the call centers, we have a very, very demanding KPI, the average handling time. And we managed to really reduce it massively. We started using the ASO process mining. Not with the current tools that we have now. It's like it was very much based on Splunk data and a very, very powerful front end on that called Disco.
Okay.
Again, it was about making an impact, and it worked actually quite nicely. And then we tried also to take the same insights into the HR function. because it was a time where finding data scientists was very, very difficult.
It still is.
But then what we've done is like we've taken all the data from the market and mm-hmm. we try to understand the best way of creating the job descriptions, the title, and it was really cool. Actually, okay. We even we were kind of qualifying meetups to go there to run, you know, to run campaigns for future data scientists.
Yeah.
We didn't end up having this in practice, but the concepts, they were nice, and I think the companies are doing that today.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, I guess there's a lot that you learned during that time. But so how did you end up where we are here today in this office here?
I mean, the good thing about E.ON or about the energy world is like when I was working for Telefonia, it was completely unknown to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the challenge is huge.
It is.
And unlike Telefonica, I mean, Telefonica, you could do, in the telco industry, you could really do a lot of good things. But if you join a company like E.ON, with your cool job, you have also a responsibility, which is actually the so-called energy transition cannot be run by itself. So you need the big players running it. And I see that as part of my job,
okay,
kind of using the data to drive this energy transition.
Okay.
And ever since I joined here, we've been doing it all across in many mm-hmm. projects. So I decided to take the challenge, and I didn't know much about energy.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't know much about energy after 3 years. And I mean, of course I know, but you can always know more. But energy is so varied that you really need years to get to all the level of details that you need. But with data in the energy space, you can do so much everywhere.
Okay.
It's really amazing.
Okay.
Let me give you some samples because so that you can just make it tangible.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right now, and it's really funny because it's happening right now, right? E.ON, I mean, energy consists of generation, consists of you have your grids, and so you do transmission and distribution of the energy. And of course, you do everything related to retail. So you really sell the energy, you have your contracts, you create energy solutions, and so on. But it's really difficult to think of a company, of an energy company, without generation. It's like Uber, right?
Mm-hmm.
Uber is not having cars, but it's kind of a mobility company.
Yeah.
E.ON is now an energy company without generation.
Okay.
Because E.ON just, of course, when I joined E.ON, they already split and they didn't do, they didn't pursue the nuclear path or the carbon path.
Yeah.
They were very much focused on large scale renewables.
Mm-hmm.
But since last year, we sold these assets to RWE just to acquire their network and their kind of retail business.
Yeah, exactly.
Which means that E.ON nowadays doesn't have any, I would say, any generation, energy company without energy generation, right? But of course, it creates a new challenge for you, which is we need to be sure or to be very certain in the way we buy energy.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end, you need to buy energy so that we can just serve our customers. But of course, if you can think of the energy market, if you know it a bit, it's like the stock market. Mm-hmm. So it's very unstable. And it requires a lot of hedging strategy, a lot of trading strategies to make sure that you buy the energy at a good price so that your customers, they don't have to suffer any price increase, whatever, right? So what we are doing here, for example, with this data, in order to create trading strategies, in order to create algorithms to kind of hedge or to assess the risk, is crucial.
Okay.
So right now, so it's just to give you an idea on how important it is.
Yeah.
But for example, take the renewables. Everybody's talking about renewables, and we would have enough renewable capacity in Germany to kind of just only depend on renewables, right? The problem is like our grid is not prepared to deal with kind of this. Suddenly, you get a lot of energy from the wind, from the north. Why? Because you cannot just infeed all this energy, because your physical infrastructure gets overloaded and so on.
Okay.
So the consequence is very clear. So you have your wind parks, and what you do is you curtail them down, which means that you kind of turn them down for a bit.
Okay, so you could actually get more energy from the wind from the wind wheels than
if you could solve the problem of getting this energy in a very stabilized way.
Okay,
right. So
is it a hardware problem?
Sorry,
is it a hardware problem, or what is the
well? The problem is, like, first of all, you don't know how much energy you are going to have.
Can't you measure?
Well, you can predict.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So can't you measure and then predict?
So, of course, that's what we are doing, right? So we have a very complicated weather forecast models.
Yeah.
So that we kind of we predict where we're going to have so much infeed. That's one step, and that's the step we are addressing right now.
Okay.
And then once you can address this problem,
okay,
you can just anticipate how much energy you are going to have on top of what you can really absorb.
Okay.
Or infeed, right?
Yeah.
And the second step would be, well, in this case, we might want to enable local markets. So you don't have to transport this energy, but you can enable where this energy is kind of in fit, you can just enable to local consumption of this energy.
Yeah,
and that's another step that we are really looking into that.
Okay,
and it's a difficult problem, but it's a problem that you can only solve with data.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's why it's so critical for the energy transition to solve this problem for us. But there are other problems that are equally interesting. For example, right now, if you think of the power grid, you think of one big central grid, and the future of energy is not central. It's rather distributed, so decentralized. And for that, of course, the challenges are kind of big, right? We are very advanced with the project in an island that actually, so that we make sure that we just have isolated setup, where we have agents, intelligent agents, steering the generation, the consumption, and the storage. So we have a big battery, we have many households, and we have a generation. And this system is just connected by a point to the central grid. With our algorithms, we can optimize for either autonomy, in terms of the dependency on the grid is minimized, or for monetary benefit, because you know that the energy that you generate, this flexibility, can be used to kind of export energy into the central grid, and you make a benefit there.
Yeah.
So we are already very advanced in these kind of setups. And in the next years, we are going to see, a huge improvement in this area.
Yeah.
And think a bit farther. E.ON is also very much trying to enable so micro generation, which is, for example, if you have a house, then we try, or we invite you to set up as solar panels. Of course, you need to meet. There are some implications, but actually, it's really good if you are creating your own energy. But of course, you probably generate more energy than what you need. And at certain time, you want to kind of commercialize this energy, right? So we are also inspecting ways of using, for example, blockchain technology to enable to local market peer to peer.
Okay, right?
We had quite a successful pilot. And
but why would you? Okay, so decentralized system. Why would be blockchain used in that case for? Identity reasons to
because it's a decentralized setup, so you don't need kind of a middleman, right?
Right.
So that's but, why okay. These blockchain technologies are very handful.
Yeah, but the thing is, would it be a system that would be provided by you, so by E.ON?
We are researching on this area.
Oh, okay. So
and but the answer is at the end. We you're going to have a product or a system.
Yeah.
So that you have kind of a local communities of energy.
Mm. Yeah.
And they are in a position of, exchanging energy themselves.
Right.
Or just getting the energy that they need from the central grid.
Right.
If they cannot generate enough, right?
Okay.
That's the future. And that's really... gets at,
yeah,
to work on that.
Yeah,
so
excited, yeah. I'm just thinking about the business application here because I'm trying to think of why would you use blockchain, right? In that sense, because blockchain ultimately is for, let's say, solving a trust issue, right? Mm-hmm. Or an identity, or a very strong identity, right? So I guess those were two things. But ultimately, I'm thinking about how a company would commercially use blockchain technology. I think it would be more or less an add-on, like a tool, more or less, to serve that security point, or let's say making sure, identity is, or let's say just argumenting with the security point that you can come up with when you use blockchain, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, in that sense, but. Ultimately, it would be then just a tool. It would be not something that you could then commercially be able to sell, I think.
Well, I mean, blockchain is just a technology.
Right, exactly. And then it's a tool. So and
yeah, it's a tool. Of course, you need to put the business model on top of that.
Exactly. So and that's clear. Is where the interesting part is. But it's quite cool. So there's a lot of interesting stuff that you do. I'm actually not sure. What is the total revenue of Yon?
It's a difficult question, and
because I know there has been a merger, right?
Yeah, that's the point. That's why it's difficult. So I'm not gonna give you a number because after the merger, so I'm not sure what the official number is.
Yeah, right?
But it can be, I think, consulted and several so billions.
Okay.
Sure, right?
Yeah, right. So I heard that that was a difficult one, but anyways, it's a huge company ultimately, and so you are in a role of, let's say, the global head for data analytics, right? So what then is really interesting is because there are certain industries companies that operate in certain verticals or industries where you would assume that they're quite quantitatively strong and, let's say, have also a quite employees or a large number of employees with a strong quantitative background, right? Which is kind of the... Well, it's a good starting point if you want to have talent or people that are able to, let's say, work within data science, right? Or work with data in general. Kind of hate the term already, data science. But yeah, and so telco is an obvious run, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, telecommunications has always worked with data. I mean, that's kind of that has always been their business, basically, right? It's to use, and they were one of the first to actually really, especially when what you mentioned with this, when it was still data mining, right? They were the one of the first that were using these techniques, So, and which is interesting now with E.ON and in the energy space, right? How is it? How many people do you have that you would, let's say, count in on, let's say, working with data on a day-to-day base, how large is your team overall,
I mean, those are different questions. First of all, E.ON, if you think of E.ON is an infrastructure company, assets company.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been operating grids for years, which means that we have many data engineers or many engineers, right? Not data engineers,
right.
But engineers. And engineers are very close to data always. Of course, they might use different methods, but they're very prone to learn data-related technologies on one hand. On the other hand, so E.ON is, the reason why I joined is like because E.ON wanted to kind of push the data topic. E.ON understood that data is going to be key in the future, right? And that's why we started bringing people. We have a central team I'm responsible for, but we have also many
decentralized
team, and we managed to put in place a setup where we optimize in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
So using having a central team, you manage to provide the right platform, the right level of expertise, the right level of standardization, and the umbrella. When you just develop something locally, you can just kind of scale it through many other countries or many other business units.
Yeah. Right?
The local teams, they are very much embedded into the businesses, which means that we don't suffer for this ivory tower syndrome. So whatever we do is kind of very much intended and driven by business value.
Yeah.
In this setup, it's really fun to work because... you have a huge community mm-hmm. of practice. You are not trapped into the boundaries of a department. So you really work cross company, and at the end, everything is measured by the impact that we create.
Mm-hmm.
We are very, 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 very rigorous in terms of measuring our impact. So at the end of the year, what I love to do is like not only to say we've done so many projects, it's like. We've created so much impact with the number, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've started something that I think is really cool, and I don't think anybody else is doing that. We started measuring the impact not only from the monetary perspective. Everything can be measured in euros, and that's good because everybody understands euros, right, or dollars, whatever. But we are also creating green KPIs,
okay,
which means that how much CO2 emissions are we preventing, and we mm-hmm. are doing that. Of course, measuring that is difficult, but come on, we have the data scientists to create these models, right? And I think this way of thinking is, first of all, it's embedding the energy transition into what we do first. And second, everything is kind of numbers driven. And that's where it's difficult because numbers means also commitment. People are not very comfortable kind of giving a commitment, but it's a way of driving this energy transition and this digitalization as well for us.
Right.
So it's proven very, very beneficial.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I also have not heard about that, companies are doing that, but it's quite interesting that you guys are doing it. So with the central team, mm-hmm. which ultimately is then, I guess, here in Munich, right?
We are, our headquarters are in Essen.
Right.
So we have a good portion of the team in Essen as well.
Okay.
And the other in Munich. So
all right. Okay. So, ultimately, I guess you already pointed it out, and you see actually the same schema at almost, well, every company that is seriously, let's say, or that has serious activities within the leveraging of data, right? That you have exactly this approach, right? You have these decentralized teams, which are experts within, let's say, this, well, business unit, you know, or within the day-to-day business, you know, that have this, this understanding of the context, right? And applying then basically these methods on within this context, and then you have, let's say, this one central team, right, which is more or less guiding, you know, and shaping basically everything that is related to, let's say, analytics, you know, machine learning, and towards, of course, some sort of or something that you can call artificial intelligence, which is really interesting. So, what I want to know from you is what are, let's say, challenges that you face?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are some of the challenges that you face in within your role, you know, and also kind of basically guiding a company mm-hmm. like E.ON? You know, what are the challenges for a company like E.ON in this space, you know, to develop itself, its skills, you know, on that level and really, you know, improving itself?
Yeah. I mean, the way of answering this question is it's a journey. So actually we are going through a journey and we are maturing and we are evolving according to the challenges we face as we move on, right? When I started, the first challenge that we face is like, what the hell is AI? Why should I care about data? Right?
Yeah.
More or less, right? So we tackled this challenge in a very, in a very pragmatic way, which is let's select five big projects Why five? Because we have five strategic areas, one per area. Mm-hmm. And let's try to kind of make sure that this project with high visibility, high engagement and so on, that we really deliver and we show the difference that we can make with that, with numbers behind, mm-hmm. right? Was kind of the, our first drop. We call this project Big Tickets. Once the organization saw that, well, actually, there's something here, so we can really make a difference with data, then we started to generate a pool. So more and more demand, more and more projects, more and more people interested in AI, right? Then we started kind of increasing the team, and the next challenge was it's still finding the right people.
Right.
And but we managed, I mean, through personal networks, we are... I mean, we really want to have diversity. For me, diversity is, goes beyond gender diversity. Mm-hmm. So we have in the team currently so 17 nationalities, mm-hmm. which is you get people from everywhere, right? Putting this team together was a challenge, and we addressed this challenge actually by highlighting the responsibility and the kind of task that we do here.
Right.
I mean, for a data scientist, to be honest, it's really appealing the challenges that the energy industry can bring.
Yeah.
It's more than just optimizing a campaign. It's like, come on, you are making the energy transition happen, right?
And yeah.
That's, so we grew the team, and then after 1 year, we are kind of a data scientist ourselves. We analyzed actually where we were and what could we do better, right? And we realized very soon that if we kept delivering the same way, we would the impact is gonna be there for sure, but yeah. We cannot scale,
yeah,
because it was very linear. Yeah, you put people, you do the next project, and you get the next results. So we designed and defined a data transformation program, mm-hmm. with a very particular goal, which is let's make AI scalable for you. And in this transformation program. We focus on particular areas just to address particular issues, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To give you one example, one area is like data readiness.
Okay.
Data readiness is like we don't know which data we have. We don't know who owns this data. We don't know the process of accessing this data. We don't know the systems. We don't know if we have regulation issues with this data. So what we've done is that we launched a program called Data Readiness, where we put in place a data governance platform, and we roll it out in country by country. Mm-hmm. So we are still in the process.
Yeah. So how's this platform then looking? Like, what physically? What is it? Is it like? Is it a physical platform, or is it like, or let's say something where people? What is this platform? So well, how does it look like?
That's the typical. The platform where people can document the data. What does it mean? So metadata management, data lineage, how data sources they belong together.
Okay.
Where you can just put in place things, or you can implement the data governance rules like the data owner, data steward, data quality manager. You can track the data quality issues. You can just flag data or data sources that are GDPR kind of affected by GDPR PII information. Mm-hmm. You can also tag other data sources affected by energy regulations like unbundling.
Okay.
It's basically a data catalog with a lot of functionality on top to implement the data governance.
Okay, so is like a system that you can
use? It's a system. It's a global system, okay. With a lot of connectors to the actual data sources.
Oh, okay, makes sense, yeah.
And what you do is like, this platform is in a position of discovering a lot of things, but of course you need some manual work to...
But that makes it a lot easier, right?
It addresses the major challenges. I mean, people in the machine learning or in the AI domain, they know that everything starts with data quality.
Right?
So that's we put it in place, and it started like a program, and now we have a department doing that full time because the
data. So they're building this platform then.
Yeah. Well, we are rolling it out. Okay. We have just 4 countries already, and we keep rolling it out.
Okay.
and it's paying off immediately, right?
Like, yeah, of course. But what is interesting? So how did you, or what is the backbone of this platform, right? Is it like, did you basically write a? So there's of course a user interface, I assume, mm-hmm. right? So and then you basically connect to the data source, or you are able to connect to the data sources, right? But what is the backbone of this platform then?
We spent almost 6 months analyzing the best data for this platform, mm-hmm. right? And a make or buy decision was made, which is let's buy one platform.
Yeah.
And we've been analyzing all of them, and we decided to go for a platform called Irving.
Okay, so you bought one. So
it's a license.
Or let's say, yeah, okay, exactly.
But we didn't build our own.
All right, that is what I wanted to have answered. Whether you build it yourself from scratch, or whether you
it wouldn't have made any sense. For us. Yeah. So it's like again, data readiness or data governance is difficult enough, and if you just complicate it with let's build our own platform for that, I don't think we would have gone anywhere with that.
By the way, that is actually a really interesting topic, because I think a lot of companies actually have that problem, that they don't have this platform. Mm-hmm. I am not sure why this is interesting to me, because I haven't talked with people about this, actually, this issue in particular, but this is like one of the biggest issues, right? If you talk about scalability, right? And not you about exactly what you said, your ivory tower, you know, or your data affine people, which know their way around, right? And where if they cannot access it, they'll find a way to access, you know?
Yeah.
But like this, if you want to have scalability in terms of that you enable people to work with data, which are not your data scientists, but let's say also in an analyst role, right? And more or less work in the BI space, or, you know, just do more or less the descriptive descriptive part, right? Rather than the more advanced things. The biggest, or it starts with actually giving them a platform where all these problems of, okay, where do I actually need to find the data? And who's in charge of that data? What do I need to keep in mind when if I want to have this data, right? Like all these, I think there's a bunch of companies that don't have this in place, actually.
Very true. And I can confirm that, because, the Irving, so our provider, they're from the States.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned that they are impressed by how a company like E.ON is kind of doing that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And not many other, I talk a lot to my peers from the DAX companies, right?
Yeah.
And I really think that we are a bit of ahead of the curve here. E.ON is very fragmented, and having this platform is key for us to make an impact. And they are taking us as we had also we are part of an kind of case study from IDC, just to show how a company as big as E.ON is addressing this particular issue. It's not obvious, but to me it's very necessary if you plan a kind of long term.
Yeah, of course. Of course. For a big company, the scalability is key. You know, if the true value will only come in enabling on large scale. You know, just having 20, 30, 40 data scientists, you know, sitting somewhere and building models will not work. You know, because that will end up in a huge bottleneck. You know, and this will not be any efficient. You know,
for sure. Another issue that we address in this transformation program, also to ensure this scalability, is like no matter how many data scientists you have, it's not going to be enough, right?
Right.
So we have to grow data capabilities everywhere because of two reasons. First, there's so much to do that you really need to do that. But second, if we get people to understand the impact and a bit to understand how this kind of modeling is done, kind of the 101 about data science.
Yeah.
If you really evangelize, we call it evangelization, these people, right? The proneness of embrace the the power of the data is going to be higher.
That is a really, really important point. And I guess there's actually a term for that. I guess there's a term for everything. For a lot of things, there's actually many terms. But there's like this term, which I think fits very good to this, is data literacy. Data literacy. And this is a really important point that you mentioned, and where we actually have a topic to talk about, where I think it's interesting to see your opinion on that, is because ultimately, what needs to happen is that you need an overall basic understanding of what is even possible. You know, that's why data literacy among leadership people, right? So people, I mean, not every person that has a team, right, has a technical background, right? But for that person, it is necessary to understand what is it even what is even possible for me to ask my people, you know, to get from data.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of what in terms of methods, tools, all that stuff, you know, because if I don't know all about this, right, there's I might think that there's a lot of questions I cannot even ask, you know, my thinking will be completely different. But if my thinking is, you know, with this understanding, basic understanding of technology and what actually is capable, and I don't need to have a computer science degree, you know, or a PhD into statistics or whatever. But if my thinking, you know, where is let's say really kind of transformed, right? Then that already opens up so many new opportunities. And I think so. The point what I actually meant is to discuss is because I think if you look at how technology develops and how services develop, right, is that ultimately everything becomes commoditized. Or consumable. When back in the days you had to build things, right? You had to build them from scratch by yourself because it wasn't there, you know, or you had to use open source materials or whatever, right? And I don't know, plug in things by yourself, you know. Nowadays, modern, everything like is software, you know, software eats everything. And then you can, and then you have this new approach where everything becomes like consumable through an API, right? So, and I believe also that to a large extent, if you look at things like RPA that is happening in RPA, or if you look at, you know, just the basic models, you know, the 101s of let's say used in from a classification or regression perspective, right? Those are things that are consumable. Right, those are not things that you need to program that where you need to open up an editor, you know, or your notebook, you know, and then I don't know, go at and write some lines of code, right? That is consumable. So, and that's why I think it's really, I guess at some point it's even like machine learning as a service, you know. What is your opinion on that? I think that there will, like, of course there's advanced modeling and the fine tuning, that is, that is where the experience comes from, but this consuming of basic machine learning capabilities is definitely happening already and will be, I think, only more advanced.
No, it's neat. Actually, it's been there for a while. Let's mention AutoML, right? AutoML is the best example, right? AutoML is now, it's a theme, but to be honest, we've been doing AutoML for years already because it's a kind of hyperparameter tuning of your models, and now you have it as a service. So what it does is like it substitutes the few lines that you could write just to try out the different models, right? Again, the mechanics can be consumable. The thinking, the skills in terms of selecting the right consumable and making sense of the output or making sense of the input that you need for this consumable, that's what I think is not going to be so easily automated. Yeah? And you've made a very valid point. It's like the management, also the management of each and every company, they need to see the possibilities, the art of the possible. You mentioned the art of the possible. And this literacy is very, very important. At E.ON, we are very fortunate. Why? Because our board is completely behind the AI topics, but especially so, a board member called Carsten Wildberger is himself pushing for that, right? So from we have really the backing from the top management on one hand. On the other hand, because it's not enough, you need to get to everybody, right? In this evangelization way, evangelization, just to increase the literacy, mm-hmm. right? We are running following actions. For example, we have our data academy.
Really?
And this data academy is like, is using for sure, so existing nano degrees from Udacity, Coursera, but with buddies. It's not like we let people alone.
So like personal guidance.
Yeah, personal guidance. But also we are very much focused on degrees for managers. So people right. like in trying to kind of get into the, what's the basic that you need to understand here? That's one thing that we are doing. The second thing we are doing is like, AI is very abstract. So you need to convince people, you need to make it concrete. And we invent something called, ITV. So okay. ITV is kind of a UK channel, TV yeah. channel. Yeah. But in our case, it was ingest, transform and visualize okay. your data. It's like bring your own data.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So people, for example, sitting in a controlling department, they were having kind of some Excel or some databases. They knew that, or they presumed that this data might be valuable for them,
yeah.
but they didn't quite know how, right? So we just use standard tools like Tableau, Power BI, uh-huh. and we make them kind of play with their own data.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's fantastic because it's like, eye-opening.
Yeah.
And we started that a couple of years ago, and the adoption is great. We do a lot of road shows.
Yeah.
These road shows, it's like demos that we visit each and every place, and uh-huh. We have our data, local data people, data ambassadors, and we show the art of the possible again. It's like very, very, in a very relevant way. We use a lot of video.
Yeah.
We use a lot of storytelling, artifacts, and at the end, these people seeing that they develop a different attitude towards data making.
Right.
Yeah,
that is really interesting. That you actually have this data academy, and the point that you mentioned that you have this one person on the board that is pushing for it, that is crucial. You need that one stakeholder basically that communicates what you think and what needs to who's on your side, right? Mm-hmm. And fights for exactly this, because if you don't have that, right, mm-hmm. if it's more like a push from like a down. Down to up. What is it? Bottom up.
Middle up.
Exactly.
Middle down. Middle.
So, like a bottom up approach, right? Then that is always more difficult. But if there's like this, if there's this person that is completely convinced of this, you know, and whose understanding is so clear that this is absolutely necessary, right? Then that's only game changing, right?
No.
We're almost at the end, and. Which is actually too bad because the conversation is always so interesting.
Yeah.
But we always try to kind of keep in that time frame. And I actually also always start the same, but also always end the same, as I told you already. And the last question that I have, or that we always have, is that because we think that we talk with people that kind of shape the future with the work they do, in some sort of way. We believe that these people also have a very strong opinion, on different topics. Our last question is always that we ask our guest, always on spot, so it's quite difficult, because you fight with yourself of, okay, really answering the truth or coming up with something because you don't want to tell the truth. But never mind. So the last question is that, we would like you to give a prediction, mm-hmm. on something what you believe will happen in a certain time frame, and don't be too, don't be like too, like, of course you can do that, and be like this, like, yeah, I think that by 2050 we'll have autonomous cars but just like something that you really think about on a daily basis, where you have an opinion on, mm-hmm. and what you think will actually happen in this X time frame X.
Yeah. I cannot make a prediction in 2050 because we don't have enough data for that, right? And it could be wrong from my side. People ask often about the singular. What do you think the singularity point is going to be? To be honest, no idea. Probably I'm not going to be alive when I'm 40 already. So, what I think is will happen in the next 5 to 10 years, right?
Yeah.
It's that in the energy industry. Let's take the energy energy domain, right? AI is going to be kind of a part of each and every development.
Okay.
It's been already a part of that, but it's going to become so completely mainstream. And AI or data is going to enable our goal is like the decarbonization. I don't think it's going to happen in the next 10 years, but in the next 10 years, we are going to know how to tackle this problem.
Okay.
It's not like we need to.
Mm.
Obviously, we have a lot of pressure now with Greta and so on. That, if we need to take the topic very seriously, and I think we are gonna get to a inflection point in the next 5 to 10 years, and AI and data are gonna play a very, 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 very crucial role here, as they are already doing. Right, things like immobility. They're going to become a reality, I think. They need to. I wish that's more a wish than a prediction.
Mm.
I wish it's true and it really becomes a mainstream thing. Yeah, that's my prediction. Something that I will tell you on top is like something that I think is going to go. It's a very strong opinion, a very personal opinion, right? Right now, if you go to each and every AI conference, you have a huge buzz around ethics,
mm-hmm.
which is very important.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, the discussions about ethics, they are even boring right now. Why? Because they are so theoretical, so abstract. Of course, we need to solve some ethical conflicts that if we delegate some decisions to machines, of course, we need to know what the implications of these decisions are, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's clear. And we are going to have a very much intensive research and regulation field there. But right now, ethics, they are being used like kind of the next buzzword when we talk about AI. My wish and my hope and my prediction is like in the next years, the ethics topic is going to be treated in a completely different way, more professional way.
Mm.
Right.
Okay.
And that's what I hope. And I'm personally engaged in that.
Right.
With we are doing it with the University of Oxford,
mm-hmm.
and with the professor there. And what we are doing.
I know you're talking about the he's what is Floridi? What is his name? Last name of the professor? I forgot. He's Italian. I know. He's the AI ethics. Is he an ethics professor?
No. I'm doing that with Professor Greenrod.
Never mind then.
No. It's like, but again, the way given that we have so much difficult conversation about ethics and the future of the mankind. So what we are doing is like, let's solve the problem today.
Mm.
And today, the people dealing with this problem, they are data scientists, mainly data scientists and data practitioners, right? So what we've done is like, let's create a code of conduct for them.
Yeah.
And let's make it this open. And let's get everybody in the academia, but also in the industry to participate and debate on this code. And that's it.
Okay.
In terms of how a data scientist should behave in given particular situations.
Yeah.
But the discussions, they are going really, really crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
And to be honest, it's more like people trying to position themselves in this space, not adding much to what the AI is supposed to do. So that's my prediction, and I hope it becomes true as well.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Juan. That is very, very, very interesting. I was really surprised that you kind of threw that last one out on the ethics, which is super interesting, and I'm not going to comment now on it, but I guess for the listeners it will be really interesting, because that is one that is there's actually a lot of people think about, and I need to say it, I very much agree with you on this like whole debate, on this topic. And the problem is that because you have a hype, you know, there will always be people that will jump into it, you know, and make themselves like very visible, you know, and then become the next AI ethics expert, you know. But as it is with everything, you know, and with every new wave, with every new hype topic, there will be these new experts, you know. So, but thank you very much, Juan, for this very, very interesting conversation. It was really a pleasure to have you on this podcast. Thank you.
It was very fun. Thank you for having me.